Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have a very special treat in store. My colleague Jim Hansen, the Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, caught up with Ambassador John Bolton, the former U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations and Undersecretary of State for International Security Policy. He is a man who has commended himself to the security of our country, authored a marvelous book on the subject, Surrender is Not an Option, and gives us a, well, critical analysis of what President Obama has done with the so-called Obama bomb deal. Here's Jim Hansen and Ambassador John Bolton.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for Frank Gaffney. We have the extreme pleasure this segment of being joined by former U.S. Permanent Representative of the United Nations, John Bolton. He was also Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security, and he currently is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Welcome, Ambassador.
Glad to be with you. Thanks for having me back.
Well, we have a monumental deal in front of us that has been sold to the public as a way to stop the Iranian government from its goal of a nuclear weapon. Have the Iranians changed their mind? Is this actually a change in policy, or are we being sold a bill of goods?
Well, I think we're being sold a bill of goods by the president. I've compared this to an American diplomatic Waterloo. The Iranians have achieved every one of their most important objectives, particularly unfreezing tens of billions, maybe hundreds of billions of assets, and getting relief from economic sanctions. And in return, they've given up only the most trivial, easily reversible concessions on their nuclear program. The fact is that there's simply no evidence, certainly the Obama administration has not produced any, that indicates Iran has really made a strategic decision to reverse 30-plus years of policy where they've been seeking nuclear weapons. I think Iran is nearly certain to violate this deal based on their past performance, probably already is violating the deal. We don't have adequate measures to detect these violations, and the agreement's so-called enforcement mechanisms really, I think, will become objects of derision in the very near future.
Folks, we're talking here on Secure Freedom Radio with former Ambassador of the United Nations, John Bolton. You seem particularly skeptical of the idea that the Iranians will comply, and I think that's justified. If they did comply with the deal, the best we get is 8 to 10 years of relief, at which point they are pretty much unfettered in their path to develop a weapon. What then should we do? Now, you've made some fairly muscular calls, as you are wont to do, about what we could actually do. Is there a path to militarily at least slow down their program enough to make it worth that fairly significant risk?
Well, here's the choice that we face, and we faced it for quite some time, I'd say at least seven or eight years. And the choice is between a nuclear Iran on the one hand and all of the consequences that that means in the Middle East and around the world, or using military force to stop it. The president has, as usual, posited a false choice. This deal is not going to stop Iran from getting nuclear weapons. And if the deal collapsed and Iran went on its way, it would still get nuclear weapons. It's a very unpleasant choice to have to talk about military force. Israel has had to answer that question twice before in its history, and it, in both cases, has struck nuclear weapons programs in the hands of hostile states, Iraq in 1981 and Syria in 2007. And that's really the choice we face. Now, you know, this is not being belligerent. After all, the president of the United States, Barack Obama, has said repeatedly all options are on the table. table, which is a code phrase for the use of military force. The problem is nobody believes the president. The Iranians don't believe him. The Israelis don't believe him. I don't believe him. So it's pretty clear that during the remainder of his presidency, no matter how many times he says all options are on the table, there is zero chance that the U.S. will use military force against Iran. That's why the spotlight's on Israel. If you don't like Iran's behavior today, imagine what it will be like once they get nuclear weapons. And the alternatives that many people talk about, bringing sanctions back into effect, reviving the ones we have and adding to them, is delusional. The Europeans are lined up for very lucrative trade and investment agreements. The pressure on the European governments to make this happen is overwhelming. And as I paraphrase Bruce Springsteen in an op-ed on Sunday, these sanctions are going, boys, and they ain't coming back.
Well, if the boss says it, it's got to be true. Now, it seems President Obama has put some roadblocks in the path of Israel taking any military action previously. And from a lot of folks' understanding of the deal as it's currently laid on the table, it seems like we're required, the United States is required, to bodyguard Iran's nuclear program. Is that another attempt to put a perhaps physical or human shield factor into stopping Israel from taking action?
Well, I think that what we've committed, at least as I read the document, is to provide the kind of security to Iran against terrorists stealing their nuclear technology or, in some sense, learning from them. And we've discussed similar kinds of protections with others, including the former Soviet Union under the Nunn-Lugar program. I think that's bad enough. After all, Iran is the world's central banker for international terrorism, and the notion we're protecting their nuclear program against other terrorists is ludicrous on its face. But I don't think this necessarily, as I read the language, requires us to defend Iran against a potential Israeli attack. But I will say this as well. This is a lengthy, complicated document. I've read through it and parts of it several times. I need to read through it again about three or four more times before I will feel comfortable that I totally understand it. And beyond that, I think it is absolutely essential that Congress, in its 60-day review process, stand up on its hind legs and say, we want every side deal, every codicil, every understanding, every wink and nod, whether they're written down or not, anything in any way related to this deal that the president has committed to. Because it may well be that there are verbal understandings, written side deals. Who knows what there is in addition to the ones that are already mentioned in the deal itself between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency. I'm just worried that the four corners of the deal itself don't contain all the critical provisions. And I just think Congress and its committees have to insist on this, no compromise on it. They need to see it. I think the American people should see them, too.
That would be a breath of fresh air. And the Senate performing its constitutional duty to advise and consent, as you mentioned, would be helpful just to illuminate all of the side deals and the other things you mentioned. One thing that has been brought up recently was the possibility that this deal may violate the provisions of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, that is an actual treaty. That is a legitimate piece of legislation with a treaty with the force of a federal statute. Is there a possibility that this executive action, which Obama purposely avoided making a treaty, may in some way, shape, or form run afoul of the actual signed treaty, the NPT?
Well, I think Iran's conduct for the last 30 years has been in violation of the NPT. So that would simply be a pimple on the body politic of what Iran is already doing. I mean, fundamentally, there's been a lot written. I'm sure there'll be more written about this legality and that legality. And just speaking as a lawyer, none of this has to do with law. This is about power. Iran's got it, and it's going to get more when it gets nuclear weapons. And we're standing back and doing nothing. Or waiting for Israel to do the job for us. That's the reality. And until we address that, until we recognize that we are allowing Iran to become a nuclear weapons state, threatening the region and the world, and it doesn't stop with Iran. Other countries in the region have seen the course we're on. We're already in the opening stages of a nuclear arms race, Saudi Arabia looking to get nuclear weapons, Egypt, Turkey, perhaps others. So then in a relatively short period of time, as these things go, 5 or 10 years, you could see half a dozen nuclear weapon states in the Middle East. That's what the president is allowing to happen.
Well, that would be a disgrace. And for a man who came to power with an avowed goal of ridding the world of nuclear weapons, I think one of his legacies may well be, as you just mentioned, proliferating them across one of the most volatile regions in the world. Thank you very much, ambassadors. We've been talking with John Bolton, former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, about the dangers posed by President Obama's Iran deal.
Next up, we're going to talk Turkey with one of the most courageous and insightful journalists in that country, Barak Bekdil. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm very pleased to say, joined by Barak Bekdil, a man who I have come to admire greatly for both his insights into what is happening inside and in the neighboring states of his native Turkey and his courage, really, in discussing them in, among other places, his column in Hürriyet Daily, an Ankara-based Turkish newspaper. He has also been writing for the U.S. weekly Defense News since 1997. You can also find his writings periodically at the Gatestone Institute, a marvelous organization. He previously served as the Ankara Bureau Chief for Dow Jones Newswire, and he's always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much, Barak. Good to talk with you.
Thank you.
I'm interested in your take on this new opening, it seems, that has arisen in recent days as a result of the Turks not only making use of airstrikes against targets in Syria, putatively associated with the Islamic State, but also opening up at last Incirlik Air Base, where U.S. forces have been stationed, enabling them to attack such targets there and perhaps in Iraq as well. What is behind this sudden turnabout on the part of President Erdogan and his government?
Well, it was clearly a miscalculation on the part of the Islamic State. Here's how it reached the point where we observe it now. Turkey was a very fragile cohabitation with the Islamic State over the past year or so, based on a mutual understanding of certain Turkish tolerance to IS activity in Turkey in return for a natural shield that would protect Turkey against any potential IS attack. But then the miscalculation enters the picture on July the 20th when an IS suicide bomber killed 32 mostly pro-Kurdish Turks and Kurds in a small Turkish town bordering Syria. So IS thought that Turkey would perceive this as an attack against the PKK, the Kurdish militants, and not against itself. This bombing the next day led to a firing, uncontrolled firing between Turkish troops and IS militants inside Syria, which resulted in the killing of one Turkish non-commissioned officer, which was the first Turkish direct combat contact with IS. And there, Turkey had to change its policy and shift towards the Allied line, which naturally paved the way for the Turkish decision to allow the U.S. military to launch airstrikes from the Incirlik Air Base.
Barak Bekdil is our guest. He is today a columnist for the Hürriyet Daily News in Turkey and also for Defense News here in the United States. And Barak, you were talking about an uneasy relationship between the Erdogan government in Turkey and the Islamic State. Would it not be more accurate to say that Turkey has had a kind of modus vivendi with the jihadists of the Islamic State over several years now, enabling them to bring foreign fighters through Turkey, to have refuge in Turkish areas, and again, preventing attacks upon them from Incirlik? I understand that that game may have changed dramatically once the Islamic State started attacking Turkish targets, but is that not an accurate way to understand what led up to this event?
Basically, it was this bombing that I mentioned that broke down this modus vivendi that you just mentioned. These people, the Islamic State people, are distant and violent ideological next of kin for Erdogan and his allies in Turkey. But there's also a huge difference between this ideological kinship that the Turkish government is in no way engaging in violent or terrorist attacks against any target. But this doesn't mean that Turkey has not facilitated the IS's activities and operations inside Syria and Iraq over the past year or so.
And they have a common enemy, of course, in Bashar Assad.
They have two common enemies, not just one, the Kurds and the Syrian regime.
And the Islamic State has been tearing up the Kurds pretty badly for most of this period. But what does the role of the Turkish military at the moment portend in terms of both the Turkish indigenous Kurdish population and that across the border in Syria, and perhaps Iraq for that matter, as you see it?
Basically, military's line, you know, the generals used to have the ultimate say in things like those in the past, but no more these days. I mean, we have a totally different picture. The military's main concern now is to be extra, extra careful in not taking an illegitimate step, both in terms of Turkish law and international law. So they're basically waiting for orders from the government, trying to put down everything in full into the paper and get their orders and get things done. But everything has to be legal, legitimate.
And from the Erdogan civilian government, not at their own initiative.
Yeah, the generals feared to be blamed in the past for anything that may go wrong beyond the border.
Particularly, I imagine, with respect to the Kurds. Our guest is Burak Bekdil from the Gatestone Institute, as well as Hurriyet Daily in Turkey. And Burak, a question that I think has probably bemused many of us is, what's going on with respect to a government in Turkey, besides the Erdogan presidency, which is supposed to be, as I understand it, more or less a figurehead role? There were recent elections. They did not go well for the AKP, the party of Erdogan. Where do things stand there at the moment, and how do the developments that you've just described with respect to the Kurds possibly bear on the future course of the government in Turkey?
Well, there are unconfirmed reports that the president, Erdogan, may be calculating that a re-election in his own wording, I mean, an early election this autumn, could work well for him, his AK Party government, because, as you know, on June 7th, the AK Party failed to win enough seats in parliament and lost its parliamentary majority for the first time in 13 years. So what Erdogan might be calculating is that in case of a re-election this autumn, this party, AK Party, may this time win enough votes to at least form a government itself without a coalition partner. But I doubt if this will in fact happen, because in the first place, we don't have a credible polling or any credible research suggesting that AK Party's votes may be on the rise. That's one thing. And secondly, if we link the situation to the new waves of terror and violence in Turkey, I see that more and more Kurdish votes will flee AK Party and go to the pro-Kurdish HDP party. And more nationalist Turkish votes will flee AK Party, this time going to the rival coalition nationalist party.
But this is really the question I wanted to get at, because I understand that there is a profound rift between the nationalists on the one hand and the Kurdish party activists and voters. Can a coalition be forged, especially in this kind of environment, between them, or do you think that they can be sort of divided and conquered by Erdogan, even if he doesn't poll that well, you know, in his own right?
Theoretically, yes, a coalition alliance can be formed between AK Party and the main opposition Social Democrats, but that's only in theory, unless Erdogan does something to disrupt the whole plan.
Burak, unfortunately, we are hard out of time. I hope you will come back to us again soon for a further drill down on both the developments that we've discussed here today and others that we just couldn't get to. But thank you for the great work you do at Hurriyet Daily, Defense News, and again at the Gatestone Institute, and for joining us from time to time. We'll look forward to doing it again very soon. Michael Cutler joins us next. We'll talk about immigration in the United States and who's coming and what does it mean straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute.
Rumor has it that President Obama may get at least one Republican senator to support his dangerously defective nuclear accord with Iran. It's said that the aptly named Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona has been focusing on the details of the Obama bomb deal and seems satisfied. Unfortunately, the devil is not just in the details of this agreement. For example, giving up to $150 billion to a regime determined to destroy America is lunacy. Committing to advance and protect its nuclear program is insane. Leaving Iran fully capable of building nuclear weapons and of securing ballistic missile technology and advanced conventional weapons to attack us is treasonous. If Senator Flake enables such outcomes, he will share responsibility for the war this deal assures, quite possibly a nuclear one, not deserve credit for avoiding it. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
They are fathers and mothers, someone's best friend, and America's true heroes. Whether out on the front lines or here on the home front, our troops are sacrificing every day, making sure that we continue to have the freedoms that make this country great.
Hi, I'm Congressman Chris Stewart. As a former Air Force pilot, I understand that our troops and their families continue to give so much for our country. Let them know you appreciate their service. A simple thank you can go a long way.
Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. Now that the June 30th deadline for a nuclear agreement with Iran has passed, Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna struggling to finalize an agreement. Listeners to this program know that the nuclear talks are deeply flawed and a bad deal is preordained. We now know one reason for this bad deal is because the Rockefeller Foundation spent millions to back a loose coalition of peace groups, think tanks, and former U.S. officials to push for a nuclear agreement with Iran. This included freelance diplomacy with Iranian officials over the past 10 years. In addition, a core member of this effort is former CIA official Paul Pillar, who wrote a 2012 article titled, "We Can Live with a Nuclear Iran." This explains why a bad deal with Iran will emerge from the nuclear talks. This is another reason why Congress must kill this deal. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at our new website on the Iran talks, irantruth.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined by Michael Cutler, a man who has had a rather remarkable and quite extensive career in law enforcement, notably with the Immigration and Naturalization Service for 30 years. He served as an inspector at the JFK airport. He has been involved as a criminal investigator in New York City, also as a representative to the Unified Intelligence Division of the Drug Enforcement Agency. Today, he is a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization. He is a very prolific writer on subjects having to do with his area of expertise, namely immigration, border security, and the mayhem really being wrought at the moment in those spaces. We'll talk more about where you can find his writings in a moment, but let me welcome Michael Cutler back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us, sir.
Thank you. Great to join you, Frank. It's always a privilege.
You wrote a recent piece that tracked a sordid legacy, I think it's fair to say, dating back to Jimmy Carter, with respect to sort of the mutation of language. Give us sort of the antecedents and talk about how that's being done today under the Obama administration.
Well, whatever Jimmy Carter did, Obama is out to beat him. I've come to think of Jimmy Carter as Mr. Obama's dementor, if you will. It's out of frustration that I say this. As an immigration agent, we were actually instructed by the Carter administration to cease the use of the term illegal alien to describe aliens illegally present in the United States. It was Orwellian. The term alien has all been expunged from the vernacular when we talk about immigration. Yet there is no insult. This is not the N-word. Alien under our immigration laws, and that's the definition that I will focus on, is simply any person, not a citizen or national of the United States. Where in the world is there an insult? It doesn't say someone's immoral, stupid, or smells bad. It simply says, you're not a citizen, statement of fact. But what has been done by using that, then to say that everybody who's a foreign national is an immigrant, so then the claim is falsely made that anybody who dare say we should secure our borders and enforce our immigration laws that are actually our first and last line of defense against international terrorists, transnational criminals, and fugitives, if you dare say we should protect ourselves, then you're labeled anti-immigrant, which, of course, is a lie. We're simply being pro-enforcement. So this is part of how it's thought.
You mentioned that the Obama administration is kind of Carter on steroids. Talk about this new term, calling such folks, these undocumented immigrants, erstwhile illegal aliens, new Americans.
It's astonishing. They can't be a new American if they're here in violation of law. But to be fair about it, we're seeing this from both sides of the aisle. Didn't you have Jeb Bush saying that coming to this country illegally was an act of love? And I would suggest that perhaps he's been looking for love in all the wrong places, you know?
But true.
I knew you would appreciate that.
I do indeed. And the thing is that what is happening here, which makes that Republican buy-in all the more bizarre, isn't it? That we've got a history, going back, I guess, to Carter, of using these immigration flows for, well, gerrymandering, as I think you put it in one of your pieces. And that has real political impact in terms of who is in this country, of course, but also perhaps even who is voting for the leadership of this country or otherwise getting representation in Congress. Talk a little bit about that, Michael Cutler.
Well, first of all, there have been investigations into aliens voting illegally, and they almost always get shut down by both parties, which always astonishes me. I think it's American Express that says membership has its rewards. Don't you think citizenship should have its rewards? But then what do I know? But when Jimmy Carter was the president and we started to do that census, we, the government of the United States, the order came down from the White House. You will not arrest a single illegal alien without getting clearance from headquarters. And just kind of knocked us all on our backsides. And we said, why in the world are we being prohibited from doing our jobs, going out and arresting aliens? And unless you could go through the chain of command, which took forever, and by then you probably lost the trail on the guy you wanted to arrest because it took days, and the guy had 14 arrests and he killed 7 people, they'd say, well, arrest him, but don't dare go near anybody else in that building or his family, just him. And you'd say, why?
And yet, Michael Cutler, I suspect looking back on it, compared to what's happening today, notably with the wholesale release of even criminals.
Those were the good old
aliens.
Days. Those were the good old days.
Exactly.
I just want to make one quick point. Sorry to cut you off. We believed it was being done. We didn't realize it at first till we sat down one day over lunch and tried to figure out what we were witnessing. It was about getting more representation into the huge cities where you had most of the Democrat voters. I'm registered as a Democrat. I've always voted as an independent. I'm being nonpartisan, but I am being American on the issue. And the idea that you're telling law enforcement to cease and desist for political objectives puts American lives at risk.
It really does. And we're seeing that in some of these so-called sanctuary cities in particular, but across the country more broadly. Again, our guest is Michael Cutler, now a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization and a man with a career of law enforcement when he's allowed to perform it, I should say. And your expertise is particularly relevant to the question that I wanted to put to you next, which is, we've been following fairly closely of late the work of Ann Corcoran and Jim Simpson documenting what's been happening under the rubric of immigration and specifically the refugee resettlement program to sort of take this gerrymandering and migration of problematic new Americans to a whole new level. Give us a flavor of how you see all of that, Michael.
I'm a big fan of political asylum. I'm Jewish. I was named for my grandmother who was slaughtered in Poland during the Holocaust. In fact, as a B'nai B'rith president, I went to Washington back in the days of LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, shows you how old I am, asking him to convince the Russians to let religious minorities, including Jewish people, leave Russia, go to any country that would have them. As an inspector, I was thrilled to admit political refugees. They came here literally crying. They hugged me. They were kissing the floor. It was an amazing emotional experience. But today, that system has zero integrity, just about. And we've seen people like the Tsarnaev brothers who got asylum, and then the whole family immediately jumped on airplanes and back to Russia. If you apply for asylum, you have to make a claim of credible fear. If I go home, I will face persecution or worse, perhaps death. So when someone can say credible fear and then immediately, without any regime change in their home country, jump on airplanes and voluntarily fly home, you got to believe they lied. Kansi, the guy who shot up the CIA in 1993, killed two CIA officers, wounds three others from Pakistan, applied for asylum. 1 month later, Ramzi Youssef, World Trade Center bombing, again, applied for and received political asylum. The 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, warned that that fraud in the immigration benefits program in general, and specifically within the political asylum program, was providing a gateway for terrorists to enter the United States. It's almost impossible to vet people from war-torn countries, especially when they're hostile to us. And when we bring people in quickly, it's a problem.
This is a whole other facet of the problem, is that these guys have figured out how to get asylum, as well as, I guess, how to engineer access to the United States through the Refugee Resettlement Program at the behest, basically, or direction, really, of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation and the UN. Let me switch gears quickly, Michael, because there's another piece of this that I want to make sure we cover, and that is the idea, especially troubling, of bringing in by the tens of thousands, perhaps to Detroit, perhaps elsewhere, of Syrian refugees that the FBI has testified before the Congress they cannot vet, given the lack of background information and identities and so on. As a guy who was at the pointy end of the spear of trying to protect us from these sorts of folks, terrorists among them, jihadists and so on, what should we be thinking and saying and doing about that prospect?
Under no circumstances should we be permitting anybody into our country that we can't properly screen. We're talking about hundreds of thousands. I want everybody to think back to September 11, 2001. And by the way, just so you know, I did my first congressional hearing on May 20th, 1997, 4.5 years prior to 9/11, on the dangers to national security posed by immigration fraud and visa fraud. So my point is this. Americans need to be the first consideration of our immigration laws. They were initially enacted to achieve two primary goals: protect innocent lives and the jobs of American workers. We've come so far afield from that. Nobody should be permitted into our country unless we are certain that they don't pose a threat to the safety of American citizens. Is that an unreasonable standard?
Let alone that they might actually be value added to our population. That used to be a consideration, too, it seems. We have to let you go, Michael Cutler. We are hard out of time, but thank you for the work you're doing, notably at Family Security Matters.
I got to put one website out, capsweb.org and michaelcutler.net, and thank you for having me, Frank.
You're most welcome anytime, and we look forward to encouraging people to follow you at Front Page Magazine, as well as Family Security Matters, and of course here in the near future, I hope. Next up, Andy McCarthy joins us on whether the president has, well, lied to the Congress, and should he be punished for it? That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitz with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the global jihad movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the global jihad movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined by the man who makes this required listening, our Secure Freedom Radio program. I'm always thrilled to have him with us, and I think all of you are as well. He is the great Andy McCarthy, former federal prosecutor turned pundit extraordinaire and best-selling author. You find him frequently at Fox, practically daily at National Review Online and or PJ Media, a prolific commentator on the challenges we're facing with respect to a lawless president, a man who is engaged in faithless execution, the title of his most recent books. Check out as well Willful Blindness and the Grand Jihad. Andy McCarthy, welcome back. Good to have you with us as always.
Frank, always great to be with you.
You have been musing about the faithless execution of the president with respect to the Iran deal, what I call the Obama bomb. Talk about what you found in the way of not just faithless execution, but outright lying to the Congress, and what your thoughts are about what should be done about it.
Well, I think that this has been, this whole Iran negotiation has been characterized by misleading statements, intentionally ambiguous statements, and now I think we're seeing flat-out lies, concealment, and conceit. And, you know, I keep going back to the same issue in my book that you were kind enough to mention, Frank, Faithless Execution. I keep going back to the reason I wrote the book, which is not so much to champion President Obama's impeachment, although I think, you know, certainly as a matter of law and politics, he merits impeachment. But impeachment obviously is a political remedy if there's not a public mood to remove the president from power. It doesn't really matter how many impeachable offenses have been committed. But, you know, putting that aside, the reason that I wrote the book is because we're in a constitutional system which has a finite number of checks on presidential overreach and abuse of power. And if you forswear those checks, you resign yourself to the president doing whatever he decides personally that he can get away with. And what we're seeing in this particular negotiation is that really play out in a major way, in a way that will be very, very damaging to American national security going forward. I mean, basically, we are in the process of not only allowing Iran, the world's number one state sponsor of terrorism, to be armed with the most destructive weapons known to man, long before they even get to that point, assuming they're not on the threshold of it at the moment.
Or across the threshold, for that matter.
Or across the threshold, right. but before we even get there, we're going to fill their coffers with $100 to $150 billion, which, you know, vis-a-vis the American economy, if you just drew an analogy, that's like injecting $8 trillion into their economy. And we're doing it under circumstances where they've been quite outright in saying that they absolutely plan to continue supporting their quote-unquote allies, by which they mean the terrorist organizations that they fought.
Yeah, and trying vociferously to bring about death to America. Andy, you are the first that I heard actually utter the word on this program, for that matter, as I recall, that this is treasonous. And I must say, I've wrestled with this ever since that conversation, and I can't find a more apt and accurate description for what the president has done here. You talk about the $150 billion and the context in which that's being turned over to these guys, and one of the things that jumps out at you is it's not just the terrorism, it's conventional arms, it's ballistic missiles, it's nuclear technology, and it's international help and protection for all of the above that is going to make it infinitely more dangerous. How can it be other than a betrayal of the oath of office and, for that matter, a violation of law?
It can't, Frank. You know, look, if this was a circumstance where the United States had a long-standing adversarial relationship with a country, and that country then came around and said, you know, look, we want to have a new relationship with the United States. I'm thinking something along the lines of Libya, where they say, you know, look, we're going to give up our nuclear program. This is back, of course, in the days after the 9/11 attack. We're going to give up our nuclear program. We're going to start cooperating with you in counterterrorism. We're going to open our intelligence files to you to help you identify people who are mutually a threat to you and to us. You would have a reason at that point to say, well, we're open to the idea of having a different relationship, but prove it to us. Here, this is a situation where this is a more powerful and more committed enemy to the United States that tells us throughout the negotiation that they still believe that death to America is not only a slogan, but their foreign policy, and which announces immediately after the deal is signed that they continue to laud the concept of death to America, and they are going to continue to support the terrorist organizations that practice anti-American jihad. So how it can be anything other than traitorous is beyond me. And look, my throat gets dry when I utter words like that in connection with the president of the United States. Up until this president, I would have thought that inconceivable. And I also think the probability is that Obama somehow has convinced himself that this is going to bring Iran around and turn them into a more normal country that won't be in an adversarial posture to the United States. But, you know, it really doesn't matter in the long run whether he's doing this out of naivete, stupidity, or flat-out insidiousness. The fact of the matter is we have a committed enemy to the United States, and he is lending aid and comfort to the enemy. That's treason.
Material support of the greatest kind. And I think those who have pointed this out, Andy, and been castigated roundly by the president for suggesting that this is turning us into the largest state sponsor of terrorism in the world, it is incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he said yesterday, I think in a reference to Senator Cruz, that, you know, how could somebody accuse me of being the leading sponsor or the leading supporter of terrorism in the world? And I'm sitting there incredulous. I mean, his own State Department, as recently as the last report that it did on this subject, concedes that Iran continues to be a major state sponsor of terrorism. The Iranians themselves have come out and said, we are not changing our ways. We believe in what we're doing. We're going to continue to do it. And Obama says, oh, okay, here's $100 to $150 billion. Now, if you had someone that you knew that was a state sponsor of terrorism or a terrorist organization itself, and somebody gave that organization assets that it knew were going to be used to support organizations like Hezbollah, the Justice Department would indict that person.
Even this Justice Department, presumably, would indict that person for a manifest violation of the law. And Eddie, you know, I'm listening to you and thinking about what you're saying. It really brings home a point that I think can't be overstated, and that is that this president didn't just get to this point yesterday. He has been pulling these kinds of gambits, these, well, I think treasonous conduct, most recently, certainly in this case, but it's been building on a lot of other anti-constitutional activities, and nobody's documented this better than you in Faithless Execution. But he's gotten away with it. And if he gets away with this, my fear is Katie bar the door in what's left of this term. Andy McCarthy, we have to let you go, I'm afraid. I hope to continue this conversation and the monitoring of these travesties with you next week, and I hope that I'll be able to talk with all of you about it again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.